Chapter 19. Some Lessons from World War I and a Few Reflections on World War II. It is constantly asserted that the comparative freedom from epidemic disease of the armies fighting on the Western Front during World War I is a demonstration of the value of preventive inoculations. We, on the contrary, believe that a study of the subject proves such a conclusion to be based upon only superficial observation. It has to be remembered that every sanitary and hygienic precaution possible was attended to on the Western Front. And here we may pause to notice that World War I was not without accompanying epidemics, providing an interesting illustration of the substitution theory of disease conditions, to which we have already alluded. Throughout history we find that plagues have followed in the wake of war, with a systematic diminution in intensity according to the establishment of sanitary and hygienic conditions among the population. Thus the Black Death of the Middle Ages was, in later times, replaced by smallpox, which, in our own day, has found its substitute in mysterious outbreaks of influenza. In reference to World War I, we read as follows. The war ended with the outbreak of the influenza epidemic of 1918-1819, just as that of 1870-1871 ended with pandemic smallpox, an epidemic which, without including South America, China, Japan and great tracts of Asia and Africa, is estimated to have claimed 8 million lives. Thus it can be suggested that the war involved the inevitable aftermath of disease, whose far-reaching ravages may perhaps be explained by the distribution of campaigns in widely diversified areas. To return to the subject of inoculation, its success as a preventive of disease can only be tested under conditions where sanitary and hygienic measures fail, and as, wherever these were wanting, whether in East Africa, Gallipoli, Palestine or Mesopotamia, disease conditions ran riot, we confess that we fail to see where the success of inoculation has been demonstrated. Nevertheless, the press is inundated with medical arguments such as the following statement by Lieutenant Colonel S. Copeman, officer in charge of the RAM College, which appeared in the Times for the 15th of February 1917. As to typhoid fever, contrasting admissions to hospital and deaths in the South African campaign and in France for the first 2 years of the war, there had been a marvelous effect of prophylactic inoculation in the prevention of attack, and to an even greater extent in the saving of life. A similar result had followed the later introduction of inoculation in the French army, which suffered heavily from typhoid fever in the early months of the war. No better criticism of the above can be found than that of Mr. E. McCormick in the Vaccination Inquirer for March 1917. The implication here is that conditions during the South African and European wars were similar, apart from the time at which inoculation was introduced during the campaigns. Now, nobody denies that sanitary conditions are a governing factor, or at least an important one, in the prevalence of typhoid. It is well known that sanitary conditions were deplorable in South Africa, whereas in France they have been, in Sir Frederick Treves' words, without parallel in the history of war. What are we to think of medical logic which, in its special pleading for inoculation, continues to ignore this vital factor? When we remember further that the two campaigns are not even fully differentiated in respect to inoculation, but that 400,000 doses of Sir Almroth Wright's poison were sent to South Africa for the army, and that in the first part of the campaign in France inoculation was hardly practiced at all amongst British troops, the grotesque inadequacy of Lieutenant Colonel Copeman's line of argument is apparent. That his accuracy on points of fact is on a par with his logic is demonstrated by his suggestion that the introduction of inoculation was later in the French army than in ours, whereas the fact is that it was not only introduced earlier, but was made compulsory by law in 1913, whereas ours is still nominally optional. The admission that the French army suffered heavily from typhoid in the early months of the war is therefore worth noting. Where we can make something of a comparison is in respect to the Japanese troops, who, in the Russo-Japanese War, inaugurated the sanitary and hygienic measures that have since been followed in the European War, where they were rigorously carried out on the Western Front. As regards inoculation, the conditions are diametrically opposite. At the time of the Russo-Japanese War, it was stated that no prophylactic inoculations are being practiced in the army with regard to enteric fever. Professor Katasato has advised them, but the army medical authorities refuse to allow them until they are better satisfied as to the results of Wright's prophylactic treatment. Yet among those uninoculated troops, the cases of enteric numbered only 1/6 of those that occurred among the partly inoculated British troops in the Boer War. The Japanese cases were almost entirely in the First Army, in which sanitary and hygienic regulations were less adhered to, whereas in the Second and Third Armies, enteric was almost eliminated, although these armies were uninoculated. This Japanese experience surely supports the argument that sanitary and hygienic precautions, not inoculation, were the cause of the good health rate on the Western Front. Foremost among safeguards for the health of the troops was, undoubtedly, the care exercised in regard to the water supply. On occasional houses in the outskirts of Lille and along the Menin Road, German notices still remained to indicate where good drinking water may be obtained. Such was the Teutonic attention to details. The history of water purification for our own troops has been described by Captain J. Stanley Arthur, in a paper read before the Institution of Mechanical Engineers on November 19, 1920, and published in The Engineer of November 26 and December 3, 1920. Here we are told how bleaching powder, or chloride of lime, was first used to sterilize drinking water in 1897 at Maidstone, where an epidemic of typhoid was raging. Its use was attended with very successful results, typhoid being rapidly stamped out. Further, we read that chlorine in the gaseous condition, although used in America to a small extent for some time, has only come into general use during the last few years. The amount of chlorine, either as a gas or from bleaching powder, required to sterilize water is quite small. At the outbreak of the war, the only method of water purification, other than that involving the use of tablets of acid sodium sulfite, that could be carried out in the field was embodied in the water cart. Attempts were made to devise a simple method by which the amount of bleaching powder required to sterilize a given amount of water could be determined in the field. The first suggestion was made by Professor Sims Woodhead, and the actual technique, involving the fitting up of a case containing the necessary apparatus and chemicals with instructions for carrying out the test, were worked out at the Royal Army Medical College under the direction of Sir William Horrocks. With this test case, known in the Army as the case water testing sterilization, and the water cart as the starting point, the whole of the water purification scheme of the Army has been built up. That the methods adopted have been successful is seen from the fact that throughout the war, there has been no epidemic of any waterborne disease. Captain Arthur goes on to speak of advances in the water cart technology and also of work done in America for the administration of chlorine gas to water for sterilization purposes. The two types of chlorinators constructed by Messrs. Wallace and Tiernan of New York have proved most satisfactory, and their direct feed type was adopted throughout the water purification plants in use in the British Army. The article also deals with stationary and portable plants and the whole process of purification. Captain Arthur also mentions the difficulty of supplying sterilized water to the troops in the East in the early days of the war, but shows that now, a supply of sterilized water can be maintained under almost any possible conditions, by use of one or the other of the various types of water purification plants mentioned, and he tells of the new plants ordered for use in the East. To this system of water purification he gives all the credit for the Army's good health rate. That this is the case is evident from the contrasting rates of sickness on all those fronts deprived of similar advantages. With a contaminated water supply, inoculation proved to be useless as a preventative of disease. And if inoculation, unnecessary under safeguarded conditions, is useless when such conditions fail, of what use is it at all? Lack of utility, however, is not the only, or the most serious, criticism to be leveled against the practice. The teachings of World War I point to inoculation being directly harmful. In a pamphlet entitled Microbes and the War, by Dr. Walter Hadwin, we find a quotation from Professor Ernest Glynn. Sickness in the South African campaign was responsible for the loss of 86,000 men by death and invaliding in nearly 3 years, yet the total number of officers and men, including native Indian troops, leaving the Gallipoli Peninsula on account of sickness from April 25 to October 20 of May be stated as 3,200 officers and 75,000 other ranks. The total has since been increased to 96,000. In short, the toll of disease and death in these modern days of serums and vaccines, with all their protecting influences against microbes, was, in proportion to the period and the respective number of troops employed, nearly 6 times greater in the last 6 months of the Gallipoli disaster than in the whole 3 years of the Boer War. The following official figures for the losses in the Gallipoli expedition speak for themselves. killed 25,270. Wounded 75,191. Missing 12,451. Sick 96,684. Taking into consideration the shot and shell from which there was no escape in that inferno of fighting, this enormous number 96,684 victims of disease, is nothing short of amazing. The sick far outnumber those killed and even the number wounded, and we should remember that of this great number of invalids, almost every man had been inoculated. The nomenclature applied to their complaints is a minor matter in face of the fact that the application of Pasteurian methods on a vast scale happened at the same time as an epidemic of the illness. Indeed, so high was the rate of sickness among the soldiers of Gallipoli that the inference must be made that inoculation contributed to it by poisoning the systems and lowering the vitality of the fighting men. In spite of this damning evidence, bacteriological diagnosis has done its utmost to demonstrate the success of inoculation by giving every name except typhoid to intestinal troubles, which, in previous wars, would have been thus classified. The process of bacteriological diagnosis has been illuminatingly divulged by Lieutenant Colonel C.J. Martin and Major W.G. Upjohn. The exceedingly doubtful agglutinin reaction was the method adopted, and, with a candor as delightful as it was unconscious, these gentlemen confessed that in patients, previously inoculated, the development of typhoid agglutinins was regarded, with suspicion. They went on to say that they only diagnosed typhoid when the typhoid bacillus was isolated or when, the case being clinically typhoid, no paratyphoids could be detected. The Vaccination Inquirer, in criticizing the report, remarks, "Thus the mere presence of paratyphoids in addition to the true typhoid was sufficient to take it out of the typhoid class, unless the patient was uninoculated, in which case, of course, the typhoid is as true as can be. We always maintained that typhoid in the inoculated would be regarded with suspicion by the medicos, and here with charming naivete we have the process disclosed by which the inoculated officially escape, and the uninoculated get it in the neck. This method of diagnosis well explains the statement of one invalided soldier. First they said I had typhoid, and then they said I had paratyphoid, and then they said I had dysentery, but it feels the same all the time." To the devout Pasteurian, an illness has little connection with symptoms or feelings. Its reality consists in the form of a microorganism seen through a microscope. As the late Mr. Stephen Paget, Secretary of the Research i.e. Vivisection Defense Society, wrote to the Daily Mail of April 16, 1920, "The symptoms of paratyphoid have a general likeness to typhoid, but the germs are different." This viewpoint of disease conditions leads to the extraordinary obsession that, provided a specific nomenclature be avoided, inoculation has gained a triumph, no matter how great the sickness rate, or even death rate, may be. That this criticism is justified may be seen from the same article in the Daily Mail by Mr. Paget. See, in the light of these facts, the infamy of the suggestion that the protective treatment failed at Gallipoli. It gives me pleasure to nail that lie to the counter. The so-called facts that provide this so-called light are given in a quotation from Dr. Charles Searle, of Cambridge, who has stated, "Before Gallipoli we only inoculated for typhoid, and the result was that out of 100,000 cases of sickness, there were only 425 cases of typhoid and 8,103 of paratyphoid. We were under the most appalling conditions. We were on half a pint of water a day. We drank from any pool of muddy water, any filthy stuff so long as it was moist. There is nothing more terrible than thirst. We had no relief, we lived in the trenches. Every man was sick, and we had something like 50,000 cases of dysentery, but we had only a very small proportion indeed of typhoid." Dr. Searle continues by giving some figures for Egypt and Palestine in regard to typhoid and paratyphoid, incidentally interjecting that there was any amount of dysentery in Palestine. All we can say is that the official figures for these countries have been repeatedly asked for in Parliament, and that they have not yet been provided. But to return to Gallipoli, Colonel Martin and Major Upjohn have described the kind of bacteriological diagnosis that brings about the naming of diseases, while Dr. Searle himself bears witness that every man was sick, and provides figures to show that nearly 60,000 were down with intestinal complaints. Granted that the conditions were appalling, we are not denying it, though they might possibly have been less bad if it were not for the extravagant assurances of the value of preventive inoculation, which inclined those in command to take less precautions about a pure water supply. What we are debating is whether our troops would not have withstood those conditions very differently had they been free from the pollution of Pasteurian interference. This obsession of viewing disease from the standpoint of microorganisms, regardless, too, of their possible variability, seems to ignore the obvious fact that in serious illness mere nomenclature can be of no solace to the patient, neither would it console a mourner to be assured that dysentery rather than typhoid had been responsible for the death of his or her friend or relative. Of what value is artificial immunity from a particular complaint if a similar complaint is its substitute? The matter must be judged upon general health and the disease rate, and when again we learn from General Smuts, in regard to the East African campaign, that disease has wrought havoc, we are once more provided with proof of the failure of Pasteurian methods in World War I. Another paean of medical victory that has been sung, even from the pulpit of St. Paul's, is that of the success of inoculation against tetanus. The prophylactic use of antitoxin is claimed to have modified the complaint. What, however, are the proofs of this claim? When we consider the commencement of the war, we find that Sir David Bruce had stated that the ratio of tetanus in September 1914 was 16 per 1,000, in October it was 32 per 1,000, and in November only 2 per 1,000. Sir David states that there were several factors at work in September and October 1914 to raise the ratio, and says that the most important factor was the prophylactic injection of tetanus antitoxin. This was not carried out during the first 2 months of the war. Although this assertion is modified by his disclosure that the amount of serum sent out to France in the first 5 months was as follows. August 1914 to 600 doses, September 12,000, October 44,000, November 112,000, December 120,000. He refers to a letter from Sir William Leishman, who feels sure that the drop in the incidence of tetanus in November 1914 was due to the use of the prophylactic dose, and does not think any large complicating factor comes in. To those who recall the insufficiency of ambulances and medical appliances in the early days of the Great War, an immense complicating factor is self-evident, and this Sir David Bruce himself acknowledges when he describes the difficulty of collecting the wounded on account of their numbers and the movement of the troops, and finally the difficulty of giving the thorough surgical treatment to their wounds which is so essential in the fight against tetanus. In passing judgment upon all preventive treatment there is naturally always an initial difficulty as to whether any given complaint has really been prevented, or whether it would not have appeared in any case. In tetanus this difficulty is augmented by the fact that the anti-tetanic injection, following customary Pasteurian procedure, as in hydrophobia, has brought about the creation of a new disease. The Lancet for 23 October 1915, refers to Dr. Monte's observations, as set forth in the Analyse de l'Institut Pasteur. Dr. Monte has collected from French sources alone no less than 21 cases of purely local tetanus, without trismus, as well as a number of similar cases in which trismus and other general symptoms later intervened. All were in persons who had received a prophylactic injection of serum. Although the form of tetanus which begins locally and is followed by trismus has long been known, pure local tetanus is a pathological novelty in man. The condition, Dr. Monte claims, is entirely the creation of preventive serotherapy. Again, The Lancet for January 27, 1917, contains an article on modified tetanus by Captain H. Burroughs, which begins as follows. There are two reasons why tetanus should be of interest. Firstly, the disease still occurs among the wounded. During the months of July, August and September 1916, at the General Hospital, we had one case of tetanus in every 600 cases of gunshot wound. And this, of course, does not represent the full liability, for cases have occurred in patients who have been evacuated to England, and possibly at casualty clearing stations also. Secondly, a large proportion of the cases which have been seen recently have been abnormal in character, and as much as the muscular spasms have not become general. They have remained localized to the muscles in the neighborhood of the original wound. In local or modified tetanus we have a new form of disease. The disease is new because its cause is new, for local tetanus is tetanus modified by the prophylactic use of anti-tetanic serum. We see the inference here that tetanic antitoxin has mitigated what, without it, would have been definite cases of ordinary tetanus. So in a military medical manual entitled Abnormal Forms of Tetanus, by Courtois, Suffet and Giroux, edited by Surgeon General Sir David Bruce and Frederick Gola, published in 1918, we find one fact alone tends to emerge, and that is the undoubted effect which antitoxin given prophylactically has in modifying the disease. But, of course, we want to know how and why. Since this new disease, local tetanus, is, on the whole, a concomitant of serum treatment, what real ground is there for assuming that it is a mild and safer form of an otherwise virulent and fatal onslaught of tetanus? Can the discharged soldier with a limb contracted for life really take comfort that but for inoculatory measures he would have been a dead man? May he not equally lament that but for serum treatment he might have retained the full use of his body? The weakness of serotherapy is readily apparent when dealing with the factor of time in regard to preventive measures. It has been stated by Sir William Leishman and Major A. B. Smallman that, it is, of course, well known that the earlier the preventive dose is taken after the receipt of the wound, the more likely it is to be of use, though with the usual prevarication that invariably safeguards all Pasteurian pretensions, they assert in the same breath. At the same time, there is little positive information as to the effects of delay. Be this as it may, they go on to describe the conditions that made delay inevitable. It should be borne in mind that delay in giving the preventive inoculation is almost always caused by the impossibility of removing the injured man from the place where he was wounded, until such time as military conditions permitted. Such cases are therefore specially liable to gangrene, and to the more severe forms of septic trouble. This confession turns the searchlight of common sense onto the question. The men who received early doses of serum were the men who were rescued soon after receiving their injuries, and whose wounds gained prompt cleansing from filth, along with its untoward influence upon their muscular and nervous systems. The men who went without or received belated serum treatment were the men whose wounds were left to fester for hours, or even days, the unhappy victims abandoned in shell holes, or left exposed in no man's land to the hellfire of shell and bullet. Is it not self-evident that these, rather than others, should have fallen victims to tetanus, quite apart from any question of inoculation? It appears that inoculation has introduced a new form of tetanus, one which vitiates statistical judgment of the death rate. We read, for example, in the same military medical manual, abnormal forms of tetanus. Inasmuch as the true local tetanus has practically no mortality, it may readily be seen how the introduction of such cases in statistics of tetanus has reduced the apparent mortality of the disease, and incidentally encouraged many observers to regard the reduction of mortality as a demonstration of the efficacy of some particular form of treatment. Leaving the prophylactic and turning to the curative aspect of the anti-tetanic serum, even such orthodox critics as Sir William Leishman and Major Smallman have had to admit that there exist wide differences of view, both as to the usefulness of antitoxin at all, and, admitting its value, as to the system of its employment. While, in announcing a case mortality from tetanus of 78.2% in hospitals in France, they were forced to admit, this, as far as it goes, does not disclose any considerable degree of improvement in the treatment employed. The contradictions between the different routes of administration throw further light upon the experimental nature of the treatment. Leishman and Smallman say, taking the intravenous route first. We are in full agreement with the recommendation of the Tetanus Committee in their revised memorandum that this route should not be used. Not only does it introduce a risk of anaphylactic shock, from which other methods are practically free, but it appears to us from our records that it has done little, if any, good in treatment. As to the intrathecal route, the study of our own cases has not impressed us favorably. The evidence is strongly against its employment. The method appears to us to possess some definite disadvantages and dangers. In at least one case, death followed rapidly after a thecal dose, when the patient was said to have been progressing favorably. Here we have a specific example of the dangers that our soldiers and sailors had to face from Pasteurian methods, in addition to the risks they ran from the Germans. For, in spite of being dubbed dangerous, this intrathecal route was the one emphatically recommended by the War Office Committee. Its decision was, apparently, based on Professor Sherrington's experiments on monkeys, and so another instance is provided of the misleading results that are obtained from the use of vivisectionist science. As regards clinical observation of the treatment, Sir David Bruce has supplied a comical instance. Detailing case mortality, with the object of seeing whether the intrathecal route had any advantage over the other methods of injection, he proved his highest mortality, 47.1%, to have been in 53 cases treated intrathecally with anti-tetanic serum on the day that the tetanus symptoms appeared, and his next highest, 43.7%, in 96 cases treated with the serum also on the same day that the disease set in. The lowest mortality rate, 26%, was in 23 cases treated with serum, but not intrathecally, on the day after the onset of the disease, while the next lowest, 26.9%, was in 26 cases which received the antitoxin any time between 3 and 12 days after the appearance of tetanus. Thus Sir David Bruce is driven to bewail. Last year, 1915-1916, the difference was in favor of the intrathecal route. Now the opposite is true. From these figures it would appear that it is better to defer treatment until the symptoms have been manifest for one or more days. Quod est absurdum. We have no argument with such a commentary on Pasteurian theories. Meanwhile, leaving the doctors to theorize, let us take the figures for tetanus that deal only with the wounded soldiers who reach the hospitals in the United Kingdom. These numbers can surely only be few compared with the corresponding number in hospitals in the war zones and other quarters. Thus there appears to be no reality in the boast that tetanus was eradicated from the British Army by the use of inoculation. Indeed, it seems the other way about, as we see more clearly by a comparison with two former wars. If we turn to the Lancet of 29 December 1917, we find an analysis of recent tetanus statistics by F. Gola. In this, while trying to eulogize prophylactic treatment for a lengthening of the incubation period, Captain Gola has to make the following striking admissions in regard to the Franco-Prussian War, where inoculation was unknown, and World War I, during which the cult of inoculation was so widely practiced. On page 968, referring to cases of tetanus, we read, "If, however, the first three-week periods are compared, it will be found that during the first 2 weeks, the mortality in the 1916 cases is slightly below that of 1870, i.e. 75.5% and 70%, as against 96.5% and 85.5%, whereas in the third week the 1916 mortality is slightly above that of 1870. This is precisely what we should expect given the hypothesis that the slight diminution of mortality is due to our improved methods of rendering first aid to the wounded and abstention from drastic operations. After the first 2 weeks, when the cases of exhaustion and post-operative shock become fewer, the mortality from both statistics becomes practically the same in the third week. On the hypothesis that the slight diminution of mortality is due to therapeutic serum treatment alone, there would appear to be no reason to account for serum treatment being less efficacious in the third week than in the two preceding weeks. It must at any rate be conceded that if the slight initial decrease of mortality is all that can be claimed for serum treatment, the result is not very encouraging. Thus a graceful apology is made for a mortality that, in the third week period, actually outnumbers that of a war that took place half a century previously. To move to more recent times, let us quote information supplied by Mr. Churchill in the House of Commons on July 6, 1920. In reply to a question, he stated that there were only 6 cases of tetanus among the soldiers wounded or injured in action in the South African War, that is, an attack rate of 0.28 per thousand. Further, he stated that there were 3 deaths, or a death rate of 14 per thousand. There were no cases of tetanus among officers. Asked to supply the same information in regard to the late war, Mr. Churchill, 2 days later, was not able to give any figures except as regards the Western Front, where he omitted to state the number of cases and deaths. The attack rate he gave is approximately 1.22 per thousand, and the death rate is approximately 0.49 per thousand. We have already seen that the fatality rate is reduced by the inclusion of local tetanus, which appears to have no mortality, but, even disregarding this convenient statistical factor, the attack and death rates remain greater than among the troops in South Africa, amongst whom, preventive, inoculation against tetanus was entirely unknown. To sum up, medical results throughout World War I did not equal in any measure the surgical. This is all the more remarkable in view of the modern improved methods of hygiene, the improved system of nursing and the grand self-sacrifice of most of the army doctors and nurses. Pasteurian methods alone seem to account for the medical success falling short of the surgical. As an example, we may cite the prevalence of sepsis. Even such an orthodox Pasteurian as Dr. Saleeby has admitted that the war, raised new problems, including that of septic wounds, of a number and kind which reach serious military importance and which the previous experience of our surgeons has scarcely encountered. The trouble was, of course, conveniently ascribed to a malignant organism inhabiting manured soil, but with the tiresome perversity with which nature knocks over such implausible excuses, wounds received at sea, where there is no soil at all, proved to be as septic as wounds encountered on land. Had our medicos followed Bechamp's teaching as the Frenchman, Galippi, has done, they would, like him, have understood the phenomena to be due to microbiosis, the part played by the crushed tissues and the extravasated blood, which, through their inherent microzymas, may give birth, in themselves, according to Galippi, to infectious elements. It seems reasonable to suppose that such trouble would be far more likely to arise in blood contaminated by Pasteurian nostrums than in the unpolluted blood of healthy subjects. The Vaccination Inquirer sums up the matter succinctly. It looks more than probable that the doctors have been at their ancient practice of sowing with one hand the disease which they pretend to cure with the other, of course in all stupidity and good faith. It is an unhappy fact that, apart from generalizations, the war provided concrete instances of the truth of this opinion. We will only refer to one example, the enforced inoculation of the Bedford Regiment on board the Empress of Britain on her voyage from South Africa to India in April 1917. Although the vessel was vermin-ridden and the water supply, for both drinking and washing purposes, quite inadequate, the inoculation of the men of the Bedford Regiment was insisted upon, in spite of advice to the contrary. The result was that 10 died on board, 5 more after landing at Bombay. In addition, 50 men were laid low with serious illness. And no official inquiry has ever taken place in regard to this highly regrettable episode, such as the smokescreen that routinely shields even the most flagrant and destructive Pasteurian incidents. As regards World War II, the information currently available is insufficient for a comprehensive review of the outcome of medical methods. There are, however, some informative anecdotes and reports. For instance, we find that Captain Walpole Lewin gives details in the British Medical Journal of July 1, 1944, of a case in which an RAF pilot developed tetanus and died 5 days after a penetrating head injury, although he had received active immunization and the standard 3,000 units of ATS 1 hour after the accident in his aeroplane. Captain Lewin accounts for this failure by inadequate surgical cleansing owing to the nature and situation of the wound, and continues to praise immunization combined with prophylactic ATS given at the time of wounding. He quotes examples to support his approval, but does not always provide full details, and has to admit contradictory results in certain instances. In any event, he rubs the guilt off his eulogy with this, his final sentence: "Proper surgical treatment and service, whenever possible, is an essential factor in the prevention of tetanus." This would certainly seem a much more comfortable procedure than the neurological complications of serum and vaccine therapy about which Major R.R. Hughes, a medical specialist, writes in The Lancet of 7 October 1944, "While neuritis can be caused by a variety of sera, it is most commonly precipitated by tetanus antitoxin." Young states that of 50 cases, 21 followed administration of anti-tetanic serum, 12 anti-pneumococcal serum, 5 anti-meningococcal serum, 2 TAB vaccine, 1 staphylococcal aureus vaccine, and 1 anti-tuberculous serum. And so forth and so on. He has more cases to add to this depressing narrative. What a mercy for our men that so many were able to be flown quickly to base to receive the surgical treatment and service, pronounced by Captain Lewin to be an essential factor in the prevention of tetanus. Another safeguard that we may be sure has been provided in World War II is the system of water purification, for which first thanks are due to Professor Sims Woodhead. Details have been given of the success of this approach in the case of Italian troops during their shocking onslaught on the Abyssinians. Simple precautions must not be pushed out of sight because of the great monetary returns that can be derived from the use of inoculation. This has not been without its unnecessary tragedies. For example, at a training center at Neepawa, Manitoba, Reuben W. Carlier, an airman from Essex in England, died on the 11th of May 1943, from a streptococcus infection, introduced into the bloodstream at the time of inoculation, according to the verdict of the jury as reported in the Victoria Daily Times of 10 June 1943. Other airmen were made ill by the injection, including 10 whose serum sickness obliged them to be taken to hospital. The terms, serum sickness, and anaphylaxis, point to the dangers incurred by the stab of the syringe. Happily, most constitutions can endure fairly heavy doses of poison. Immediate discomfort and pain are in case after case glossed over, while malignant aftereffects, more likely to be suffered by those who do not react at the time of the operation, are usually too far removed for the realization of any connection. We may be certain that World War II has been fought not only against human enemies, but also against subhuman nuisances. In the case of such an unpleasant creation as the louse, it seems superfluous to act as counsel for the defense and insinuate that its share in outbreaks of typhus may possibly be overrated. We may well rejoice in the discovery of such an effective insecticide as DDT and the earlier methods of louse control that are said to have been relatively effective among our troops before the introduction of mass immunization during civilian epidemics of typhus in 1942 and 1943 in Egypt and North Africa. For the control of the Naples epidemic, after the landing in Italy of the Allied forces, DDT is apparently given the credit. Two British soldiers went down with the complaint, and one died. So he certainly had no help from the anti-typhus vaccine with which he had been immunized 9 months previously. No one can be particularly anxious to act as advocate for the noisy and voracious mosquito. Nevertheless, there is danger in the shifting of responsibilities from human beings to insects. Kill the mosquito and you will kill malaria, crowed Sir Ronald Ross. As a reply comes the report of the Malaria Commission of the Health Organization of the late League of Nations, in which, on page 13, it is stated that belief in the causation of malaria by anopheline mosquitoes has been a big obstacle to the control of malaria. According to the annual report of the Medical Council in 1933, the total number of sufferers from malaria has increased rather than diminished. In spite of incontrovertible evidence on all sides that the mysteries of malaria are profound, highly involved and still largely unfathomed, the childish accusation continues against an insect that, being fastidious about her meals, feasts for the most part on the healthy blood of those who never go down with malaria. So trying is the complaint that a welcome must be given to Mepocrine if it has really worked the wonders ascribed to it during the campaign in Burma. But as it appears to be a suppressive drug, its aftereffects, whether for weal or woe, seem yet to have to be recorded. In the United States, the authorities apparently feel at liberty to trumpet the success of the medical department of the American Army. On page 26 of The Lancet of July 7, 1945, we find reference to a press conference on May 24 at which the United States Acting Secretary of War stated that 97 out of every 100 men who reach a hospital have their lives saved, as compared with 92 in the last war. During the past 3 years, the U.S. Army had less than one death from disease per 1,000 men per year, compared with 19 in the last war. Malaria had been reduced from hundreds of cases per 1,000 men per year to less than 50, and the incidence of dysenteries, which once put entire regiments and armies out of action, has been less than 9% per annum. It all sounds splendid. Until we read that, the Army Medical Department during 1944 took care of 4,435,000 patients in hospitals, 2,315,000 in the United States and 2,120,000 overseas. Do 4,435,000 hospital patients, more than half the number in arms, signify a glow of health irradiating the American fighting forces? We merely put the query. One answer may well be that much of the sickness was deliberately induced by fatal procedures for which Louis Pasteur must bear the primary onus. For instance, in Newsweek of 3 August 1942, reference is made to a statement by Secretary Stimson of 28,000 cases of jaundice in American soldiers' camps, with 68 deaths. It was acknowledged that a serum supposed to combat yellow fever was probably responsible for this victimization and slaughter. Newsweek. Trying to whitewash this virus, comments. Jaundice usually occurs when the liver gets out of kilter and discharges too much bile into the bloodstream. Could the many inoculations given soldiers to protect them from various diseases have overtaxed their livers? You cannot tamper with the body without risking disaster. Yes, Louis Pasteur, the revelations of time, to which you yourself appealed, have proved you to be stupendous as a businessman, but the worst of meddlers in medical methods. For there is a body of evidence that no monetary returns can obscure, no prevarication and prejudice blot out, the evidence of the facts, the danger signals of experience. though the careless may pass them by, to the observant they stand out in warning, like the ominous hand that startled the roisterers in ancient Babylon. And, happily, there are still Daniels in our midst with the gift of interpretation. We shall consider this writing on the wall in the next chapter.